What is something that you really struggle with now?
I'm not where I want it to be. I'm trying all these things, and I'm kind of tired of failing, to be honest. So let me do something else. Let me just do something for me. And so having a friend that is going on the same journey as you are helped a lot. And so we were always feeding off each other, recommending books, getting up at 5 a.m. in the morning, like all these sort of kind of traditional things we would do to get into the realm of self-development. I just had this realization one day that when I looked at him, and I know the kind of man that he used to be, and I looked at him today, the only word I could really use to describe him is that he'd become harmless.
The whole world is wiring us to become more comfortable. Like, you kind of, your goals of this career and everything is to become more comfortable so you can live the life you think you want to live.
Very often the goals we set for ourselves aren't goals that matter to us. They are goals that are kind of influenced by the world around us. There are just so many things happening in our lives that if we aren't reminding ourselves of what we want to do and who we want to become, then we are likely not to do that. That's a very important part for me of why I do what I do. I want to help people get it right.
Eric, you're a successful speaker, author of multiple books, and an executive leadership coach. But where did it all start for you?
So I graduated as a physiotherapist in 2007. I'll take you back that far, and then if you want to go further, we can talk about going further back. But I graduated as a physio in 2007 at Wits University. I do my Zuma year in 2008, so that is your community service year. I did that in Pretoria Academic Hospital. And then in 2009, I started working in private hospitals. And I spent most of my time working in intensive care units. I bounced between various hospitals. But almost like immediately from the moment that I graduated, I realized I didn't want to be a physio. I wanted to do something else. And I didn't know what. I didn't have any other experiences in other roles or any other sort of work. But I meet a friend who's very much into the digital space. And so at that point, what was very popular was you build a directory website. You get people to pay you lots of money. You remember that sort of time? And you live the dream because people are paying you to be hosted on your website. It was this whole like massive drive towards passive income and do as little as you can online, but you get all the money. And so I get hooked on the idea of building an online business that makes me a lot of money while I'm just doing nothing.
Sounds like a good recipe.
Sounds like, yeah, amazing. And of course it doesn't work. So I end up, I think over the span of like 3 or 4 years, I registered more than 50 domains. And every time I thought this was going to be like the business that's going to make me a success. But of course it never worked because like you have the idea, you start building it. You have like this new idea, you start building that. You have the new idea, you start building that. And if you've ever been a business, then you know that growing one business is hard enough. Trying to do two or three in parallel is a recipe for failure. So I'm still a physio, but I'm trying all these side hustles that never work out. And eventually around 2015-ish, I go, this isn't working. Like I'm trying all these things, and I'm kind of tired of failing, to be honest. So let me do something else. Let me just do something for me. So I create a website called Better Man. Because I've always been fascinated by self-development, and the premise behind Better Man was quite simple. How do you go to bed at night a better man than when you woke up that morning? So the initial way that I wanted to just sort of share my journey, this was all it was. It wasn't to make money, wasn't to be rich. It was just to share my journey of trying to be a better man. So I started interviewing people on a podcast. Podcasting was very unknown back then. You know, today it's all the rage. Back then, very few people actually knew about podcasting. But I started interviewing like sort of Tim Noakes and Mops Maponyane, and I wanted to get their take on how they became better men. And I try a few different sort of formats to see what would stick. And eventually, I started daily email because I thought, you know, what we really need is to be more intentional as men in how we go about this process. And actually what I need more than anything is a reminder every day that this is what I'm recommitting myself to. So I start this daily email and it just takes off. over the course of a year and a half, it grows to about 18,000 men that receive this daily email. And so as the community grows, the guys start saying to me, well, you know, can you do events? And as an entrepreneur, your answer is always, yes. No, but I'll figure it out, you know, or yes, but I'll figure it out. And so we start hosting events. We get amazing sponsors on board. We called it Suit Night. So everyone would dress up in suits. We would have whiskey sponsors. We'd have fragrance sponsors involved. Typically, we had maybe between 30 and 50 men join for the night, and it became like a monthly thing. Next question was, can you do coaching? And the answer was, yes, I'll go figure it out. So I find all the coaching books I can find. I read every single book. I've never been a fan of like doing it the way people tell me to do it. So I try and create my own coaching frameworks. I start coaching, realize that I like it, but I'm not good at it. And it's also in that same sort of time frame when everyone became a coach. Like, you know, people wake up in that morning, they go, oh, I want to be a coach. And all of a sudden, like, you just see this abundance of coaches pop up everywhere. So I wanted to differentiate myself from I woke up in the morning, I'm now a coach. So I did my master's in business and executive coaching. And all of this, so by the way, I'm still doing physio while I'm busy with all of this. So Better Man at that point was still a side hustle. But as I finish my master's, I go, I think I want to, or I've actually always known that I want to play it at a very high level. And what that represented in my head, at least, was working with large organizations and working with their leadership teams. And so as I finish my master's, I start veering out of healthcare and into the corporate world. And I get to this very tough decision that I have to make around Better Man, because a big part of the new type of work that I was doing was keynoting. And I had this weird thing happen where people would come to me and say, are you able to speak to women? It's like, of course. But like, you know, a very interesting thing that you find that when you're trying to reinvent yourself is people have a very specific box they create about you in their heads. And to change that box is extremely difficult. And so I completely understood why people thought of me as the masculinity guy and not as the leadership guy. I still had to earn that over time. But unfortunately, one way that I had to earn that was I had to let Better Man go. And so it was a very, very difficult decision for me. We had 18,000 men on the email, but we also had about 18,000 men in a Facebook group. So it was this big community. And I really felt like I was letting them down by making this decision. It felt quite selfish to me in a way. But I also knew that this is what really excited me and where I needed to go. And it's always been something about how my life has sort of unfolded, is that it's always just been kind of flowy, like it's kind of unfolded in front of me, you know, and I know that this is where I need to go. I haven't pushed myself into new areas. I've just always been pulled into it. So I had to make the decision to let it go, and I did. And since then, it's been incredible. I've worked with organizations across the world, from Young Presence Organization in New York, Microsoft, PepsiCo, all these amazing organizations, to help them think about leadership, to think about how do we build and cultivate high-performing teams, and how do we get our leaders to become masters of change in a time where that is the most important thing to be, is to have a good grip on where the world is going and how do we need to show up in a way that we are relevant and that we are valuable to the people around us when this change has happened.
Sure. There's a lot that I want to unpack there. Where I want to start is, where did the intrinsic drive to become the whole concept of being a better man when you wake up, where did that come from? Like, obviously, there must be some sort of drive from a young age where you felt that the continuous progression of personal development or self-development and getting yourself better. Where did that come from?
I wish I could identify a specific point in time. It feels to me like it's always been ingrained in me. Perhaps there's a service element to this, you know, that my mom is a psychologist and my dad is a pastor. And I kind of became the ultimate intersection of the two, is that I get onto stage and I speak about how to be a better person. So in a way, I've kind of become the perfect intersection of the two. But I think maybe perhaps just in looking at my parents, that's what they always inspired others to do, is to grow, to find fulfillment, to fix what's not working. So perhaps, like, if I had to, like, really guess, you know, where would that, what would be the origin of it, that might be it. But it kind of feels to me like it's always just been ingrained in me. I don't know if I can say, you know, this one specific thing created it. I do remember that, must have been 2011 or so, that friend of mine that I mentioned, when we connected, we became obsessed with this idea of self-development at the same time. And so having a friend that is going on the same journey as you are helped a lot. And so we were always feeding off each other, recommending books, trying to meditate, getting up at 5 a.m. in the morning, like all these sort of kind of traditional things that you would do to get into the realm of self-development. We were going through all these things at the same time. And so seeing him on this journey inspired me. I think seeing myself on this journey inspired him. And it just became this sort of snowball effect over time.
Hmm. Speaking of books, your book, Dangerous, where did that come from?
My first coaching client that I had was the CEO. So one of the fortunate things was, because of Better Man, I'd built up a lot of trust in the community. And so when I started coaching, just coming out of my master's, I was able to start coaching at a very high level straight away, purely because, at a much higher level than I was competent at, I'd say, but because people trusted me. You know, they pulled me into their teams at a high level. Guys were able or willing to give me a shot at coaching them. And so one of the guys that I coached early on was the CEO of a very successful business. He sat in the session with me on the day, and it was a very peculiar session because everything in his life was amazing. You know, like, when you looked at him, there was no reason to feel sorry for him. His business was doing well. His team adored him. He had good relationships with everyone in his family. He was in good physical shape. Like, everything was going so well. But when we were speaking, something was just sort of missing. There was, like, there wasn't energy or passion or, like, a fire. There was just, like, I was, like, just, like, there's no bite to you, you know? And so we spoke about it for a bit, and we realized that actually, like, even though things are going well in his life physically, financially, emotionally, he was in survival mode. And survival mode is this thing that we've now all experienced over the past few years. You know, we dip in and out of survival mode all the time. But survival mode to me has three characteristics. One is that when you are in survival mode, you are always reactive. You're always just trying to get through the day. You are always putting out fires. You're never thinking about tomorrow. Number two is that you operate from this place of fear, frustration, and anxiety. And when you operate from fear, frustration, and anxiety, there are these cognitive distortions. The distortion of probability and the distortion of severity. Distortion of probability says things are likely to go wrong. Distortion of severity says that when they go wrong, it's going to be catastrophic. And so what happens is during the day, you are reactive. You are going, going, going. Your hands are busy. At night, your hands go idle. Your mind fires up. You start thinking about your challenges. You think, oh, man, things are likely to go wrong. When they go wrong, it's going to be catastrophic. What does that do? It creates more fear, more frustration, more anxiety. What does this mean? Next day, you get back into being reactive. And this brings us to the third thing in survival mode, which is that the things we do in survival mode keep us in survival mode. And a great example of this, actually, is there was a show recently called Indie Soap. Did you see that?
Yeah, yeah.
You might be the first person who I've asked, have you seen it? And they said yes.
It's because I'm Afrikaans.
Because you're Afrikaans. Because, yeah, most audience I speak to are English, and, like, they always... So for the English speakers, Indie Soap would literally translate to in the soup, but it really means that you are in trouble. So what I loved about the show was that it showed survival mode in its full glory. And it showed how being in survival mode keeps you in survival mode. Because what happened? We would have a business that just went through COVID, so they've lost revenue. They lose revenue, then they cut their marketing spend. Because they cut their marketing spend, less people see the business, less people come into the business, meaning less money back into the business. Less money into the business means, well, let's maybe find a different supplier for our food. So they lose quality. People come into the business, they don't enjoy the food, they don't come back, they tell their friends, don't go to that restaurant, the food is bad, less money into the business. Less money into the business means we need to let some people go. So we let people go, the service drops. People come into the business, they don't have a good experience, they don't come back, they tell their friends don't come back, less money into the business. And so perpetually on and on we go, that the things we do in survival mode keep us in survival mode. And so it was clear to us that even though things were going well in his life, mentally though, he was stuck in survival mode. So the thing that I was really interested in was how did he get there? Because survival mode is where he's ended up in, but what happened to him? Like, where did things go wrong? And so I thought about this for a long time, and maybe about a week and a half or so after that session, I just had this realization one day that when I looked at him, and I know the kind of man that he used to be, and I looked at him today, the only word I could really use to describe him is that he'd become harmless. So he lost his bite, that there was nothing formidable about him anymore, that everything that made him who he was, that led him to that moment, that made him the leader that he was, that helped him to build the family unit that he had, all of that, like the person that built that wasn't present in that moment. I'm like, you're harmless. Like you don't have, you're not formidable. You've lost your bite. Like, where's your energy? Where's your fire? And so we spoke about that in the next session. And he said, yes, like that actually describes him very well. Like, he actually does feel harmless. Doesn't feel like he's having an impact in the world. And so we spoke about it for a while, and right towards the end of the session, I said to him, well, if you're not going to be harmless, what do you want to be? And he said, dangerous. And when he said that, there was just something that kind of clicked for me, where I felt like, yes, like, of course, like, I also want to be, like, I want to feel dangerous. I want to feel like I can make an impact. Like, I'm moving through the world with meaning and substance. And it felt like we just redefined or defined the state, which was about moving forward, being audacious, being bold, being formidable. And so that set me on a quest to kind of uncover, what does it mean to be dangerous? Mm-hmm. And that's what the book's about.
Let's unpack that for a while, because obviously, like you said, that guy had a lot going for him. He had everything that, if you paint the perfect picture of being fulfilled, living the life, then he pretty much had that. So why do we spend 5, 10, 20 years of our lives to achieve those things, only to realize at that point that we've become complacent, numb, harmless, in the words of the book? How do we either change our goals to be different so we don't get to that point, or how should we reason or think to keep that sense of danger and being audacious and taking big risks and being adventurous? And because I think the whole world is wiring us to become more comfortable. Like, you kind of, your goals of this career and everything is to become more comfortable so you can live the life you think you want to live. But in so many cases, including this example that you've shared, once you've reached that point, and you've got people like Jim Carrey that has said he wishes that everybody can be rich so they can see that it's not all that. And a lot of people that have achieved great things come to a point where they just realize, wow, this isn't what life should have been about. So how do we wire ourselves differently, or how do we change our goals to not reach that point, but rather stay in this growth trajectory that keeps on growing and moving forward?
So I think there are a few things in there, and I can actually answer all of it through one model. Have you heard of the 1-in-60-degree rule? So in aviation, there's this principle that they call the 1-in-60-degree rule, and it says that when a plane takes off, it's heading in a very specific direction. It has a destination, obviously. But if for some reason a crosswind pushes that plane 1 degree off course, then by the time it's traveled 60 miles, it'll be an entire mile away from where it's supposed to be. And obviously, the further and the further it goes, the further away it is from its intended target. And so the same thing happens to us, that we have a specific destination that we are heading towards, something that's meaningful and important to us. But then at some point, something happens and we go 1 degree off course. And we don't course correct. And we keep drifting, and we keep drifting, and we keep drifting. And at one point, there's an awakening, something happens. And unfortunately, for most humans, what that means is that there's catastrophe. Something big has to happen. And we go, geez, I'm so far away from where I wanted to be. And so when I discovered this principle, I actually wrote about in a leadership manual called The Art of Recalibration, because that is what is required, is that we need to be able to constantly recalibrate to make sure that we are heading to where we want to go. And if we use this model, it means that there are three aspects to that. The first is that you need to have a destination, but that destination needs to be true to who you are. And I'm sure you've seen this over and over, and you've alluded to this now as well, that very often the goals we set for ourselves aren't goals that matter to us. They are goals that are kind of influenced by the world around us. So it comes back to this principle of mimetic desire, that we look at what others have and we go, well, I want that too, until you get it and you realize actually you didn't want that at all. And it's one of the hardest things to figure out is, what is it that I truly want? So there's no good way to help you get there. It's something you have to just figure out for yourself by stripping away the influences from the outside world. But so we need to be clear on, what is that goal that I'm heading towards? Without that, you are just floating anyway. Once we have that, we need to know that we are going to drift, that the drift is inevitable. And that drift happens for two reasons. Either the world around you changes, and so all of a sudden you are, but of course, you know, something big happens, a new technology, a new, you know, pandemic, whatever might happen. And all of a sudden, the world has changed, and therefore, like, the way that you are approaching your goal might need to change as well. You need to recalibrate. But I think what happens mostly for people is that they drift because there's a shiny object and they want to do something else, or they get lazy, or they get distracted, or they go into survival mode. And the drift's biggest weapon is that it's invisible to you. You don't realize that you are in it. When we are in survival mode, and the things we do in survival mode keep us in survival mode, we don't realize we are in it. It seems so obvious. Like, from the outside, we can often see that people are in survival mode. But once you're in it, it's so tough to recognize that your patterns have changed. I once spoke to a guy who, he didn't used to drink. And then all of a sudden, he was drinking like 6 beers a night. And then it became 8 beers a night. And he didn't realize that it was getting worse and worse and worse and worse, until it got to the point where his wife and everyone had to sit down and talk to him about it. And you would think that, oh, like, it should be so obvious to you that, like, the path you're going down isn't the right path to be going down. But it's not. Because once we get stuck into our habits and our routines, even if they're taking us down the wrong path, we don't realize that we are doing that. But then the third, so you will drift. That's inevitable. The question isn't, will I drift? The question is, how long will it take me to recalibrate and come back into alignment with my goal that I have? And so that's the third aspect of this, is, one is, I know where my goal is. Two is, there's a drift that happens, and I'm cultivating the self-awareness to know, okay, I need to recalibrate. And then the third thing is, okay, I bring myself back into alignment. This means, what are the behaviors that need to change to bring me back into alignment so I can move towards my goals? Usually, people don't need help with this, because usually we know what we need to do. We just don't do it. What we need is the awareness to know, okay, it's time to recalibrate. So I think that sort of wide-ranging, trying to answer that question for you.
If you are in survival mode, but you don't realize that, is there questions that you can ask yourself? Because like you said, it either needs to take a catastrophe or some big situation or happening in your life to put you on a course direct, or to just make you aware of, where am I in life and what am I really doing? And I think COVID obviously did a lot of that. I think the Great Resignation, people were like, why am I doing this to earn my money and all of those things. But maybe you are completely unaware that you are in survival mode. You're going through life, you look at your year at the end of the year and you're like, eh. You know, you kind of have this complacent mindset, but you don't really know what it is. Because I feel that the whole narrative around flourish is getting unstuck. You might not even know what is bringing you to the place of being stuck, but a lot of the people don't know they are stuck until something like that happens, or whatever the case might be. But is there, from a self-development point of view, questions that you can ask yourself when you, or symptoms that you can identify in your own life that kind of says that, yeah, like, I'm in survival mode, I'm being complacent, and I'm not dangerous at all?
Well, one would be, if you are being reactive and if you are catastrophizing. That, to me, usually signals that I'm in some sort of survival mode. I'm thinking that things are just going to keep getting worse. But outside of that, it's very difficult once you're in it. You know, there's that thing that says you can't read the label from the inside of the bottle. And that's true. So the way I would actually go about it is I would have an idea of what are the actions that would lead me to my goal, or who is it that I want to be? You need to have some sort of benchmark, because otherwise you don't know, like, where I'm operating at the moment, where my mind is at, is that optimal or not? You know, like this, I'm talking about, like, if you're deep into it, you need to do that exercise and ask, like, what does best look like? Then you can benchmark against that. But I think the better way to do it is that you need to have a daily practice of self-awareness. Usually, probably easiest is some sort of journaling practice. It might even be one question that you just keep coming back to, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how did I feel today? How did I perform today? Whatever, it could be many things. And then to continuously benchmark yourself against yourself so that you can notice that, oh, on certain days I'm lower than other days. Okay, because survival mode doesn't mean I'm in that all the time. I can wake up this morning feeling very much in survival mode, and by the afternoon I can be like, okay, cool, I'm ready to go again, I feel great. So we shouldn't think that survival mode just means that I'm in this sort of lull for weeks or months. It can be that, it often is that, but it can also be for 2 days in my week I'm in survival mode, and then I'm out of it again, and then for one morning. So I think what I'm trying to advocate for is you need to know yourself better. And I say this and you might go, oh, but of course I know myself better, or as well as I should. Research tells us that only 15% of people have a high level of self-awareness. And when I saw that stat the first time, I thought, geez, that's crazy. I think they must have gotten it wrong. But the more time I've spent with people, helping them assess their self-awareness, the more I've realized that stat is probably spot on. That even as I'm sitting here today, I think I have a high level of self-awareness. And I often catch myself out, like, not being aware of something that I'm doing or a way that I'm showing up. So it's a continuous battle. And part of why we don't get to that high level of self-awareness is because we will always have a cap, because you can't see what you can't see. You don't know what you don't know about yourself. And that's why we need the people around us to fill in those blind spots for us.
I'm curious, for a high performer like yourself and a person that's playing in this space, what are your goals? What is Eric's North Star, and where are you heading?
Sure. There's a few different goals that I have. One depends how granular we want to get. You know, so like at a granular level, I have this emailer called the Daily Leader. I have a goal of having tens of thousands of daily readers on that emailer. So I want to get back to my sort of better man days. It's kind of the better man thing, but this time for leaders. So I have granular sort of goals like that have been set around the mailer, around my speaking practice, around Modern Breed, which is where we mainly do work with teams. And then I guess at a very high level, the main focus for me is to just be building more internationally. I like the work that I do. I find a lot of fulfillment in the work that I do. I just want to do it on a grander scale.
The whole idea of doing it on a grander scale, what is the intrinsic motivation to do it at that level? Is it, do you think it comes internally in terms of you want to feel that level of accomplishment, or do you think it's that you want to be the person that adds that level of value to the audience?
It's both. When I look back at everything I've ever done, it's always been to be in service of people. You know, whether that's been physio, mobilizing people, helping them get over and through trauma, whether it's been better men, helping men to figure out what does it look like to be better fathers, better partners, better leaders in their own right. Whether it's what I'm doing today, helping people to figure out how to collaborate better, lead better. I've always been in service of people. So obviously, like, an important thing for me is how big an impact can I make? One thing I remember about Better Man was that I had a folder in my inbox with all the testimonials I received. And at some point we had more than 1,200 testimonials in my inbox. So it was phenomenal. And to think, you think of 1,200 people, but like, you have to think about the knock-on effect of it as well into families and into children's lives. And, you know, so your reach can extend so far, and especially through the platforms like we have here. You know, like, you never know how far your message travels. So one part of it is definitely impact. And another is just, I want to see how well can I play the game, you know? How big can I go? I don't have aspirations to necessarily be the absolute best. I think there's a level of sacrifice that is required to get there that I'm not going to make. But I do want to see how far I can push it.
How do you stay, like, obviously there were different seasons in your life, and especially within coaching and keynote speaking, like, your audiences grow, their responsibility grows, the money grows that comes with it. How do you keep yourself grounded throughout those stages to still stay the humble Eric that you are and grow through those stages but not become arrogant? And that usually comes or can come with the environment. Mm.
You know, my impulse answer to you is that I don't think I've achieved enough success yet to be arrogant. So that would be my first answer. Actually, that's my only answer. I don't think I haven't achieved the level of success that would warrant arrogance.
Do you ever think you will get to that point where...
I think I'm... Will I get to that level of success? Yes. Will the arrogance come with it? I don't know. Perhaps. But then I know my wife will definitely keep me grounded.
Can't keep you grounded.
Definitely, yes.
Let's talk about leadership. Before the podcast, we shared a few thoughts around leadership and the status quo of that. Leadership is obviously becoming increasingly more difficult as technology evolves and as the demands on businesses and on our personal lives evolve as well. I want to especially take the conversation to young leaders. Like, I don't want to talk about the 55-year-old CEO. I want to talk about the younger generation that goes into management, that goes into leadership positions. How do you equip yourself from a young age in a better way to grow into that leadership? Because the conversation that we had was obviously that you can take a nugget of Simon Sinek or Gary Vaynerchuk and you can follow that as he's a good leader. I'm going to adopt that in my company or I'm going to adopt that in my practices and then think it will work. But that might not be the case. And we also discussed the example of promoting somebody into a management role without having that experience of how to lead people, how to lead yourself, how to lead the department or the situation or your responsibilities. How can young leaders equip themselves? What books should they read? What podcasts should they listen to? What should they do in their own personal lives to equip themselves and enable themselves to become a good leader?
Yeah, leadership is one of the toughest things to get right because nothing prepares you for having to lead people and having people look up to you and having the responsibility of directing where a company goes, but also where the people in the company, where they grow to, you know, or who they could become. So it is a daunting, daunting task and extremely complex. I'm often frustrated that we don't take more time to train leaders, not only in terms of how they should build teams, because, like, if you think of, let's take, you know, what is the main sort of unit in a business? It's a team. So business is a team sport. But how often do we actually take the time to train people on how to collaborate well? What is most teams, how do they come together? We start a business, we have a few people in the business, more people join, as people join, they just become part of the team. Over time, we hope that the team kind of figures out how to be a good team and how to work well together. That's our formula for how to be a good team. But when you look at the research, you realize there are so many things that go into making a good team, yet people are never trained on it. And so, like, I think in a few different ways about this. One is that many, many years ago, like when I was in Standard 8, I dated this girl whose dad was a great musician, but he never knew any of the chords. Like, he could play a specific chord, but he couldn't tell me the name of the chord, you know. And so, like, he knew how to do some things, but, like, he never had the understanding of why things worked the way it would, you know. And I think it could have been so much more if he had more frameworks and more understanding of what he was trying to accomplish, you know. he was kind of winging it instead of saying, well, okay, let me understand some of the theory. Let me understand some of the composition and how to structure it and how to put it together. I think he capped himself because he never took the time to understand that. In the same way that I think leaders and teams cap themselves if they don't understand a little bit about what makes a team work. What are the team dynamics that we can expect? How can we influence those dynamics over time? And so what we then see is, because we don't have that, your blueprint of what a team should be is created by the team that you are on today. But then fast forward 5 years, and you're sitting with a team where people have come from different teams. Some of them were in toxic teams. Some of them were in highly dysfunctional teams. Some of them were in teams that did okay. Some of them were in teams where we talk about our team as a family. And what happens, we all come together, and now we try to be a high-performing team, but we all have a different blueprint for what that team looks like. So how do we build a high-performance team when we all have a different blueprint? Makes no sense to me. So I feel as a leader, you should have a very clear blueprint of what a team should look like and how we collaborate and how we lead a team. And once you have that blueprint, it's your responsibility to disseminate it to the team to make sure that we are all now playing and working with the same blueprint. And so what that comes down to is that if you're a young leader, it's good to read a wide variety of books. I can't say that I found like one or two books that, like, if you just read this, then it's good enough. You need to read a wide variety of books. But what you need to compile it into is your leadership operating system, which is, how am I going to lead? You need to be able, ultimately, you should be able to articulate to me what your leadership style is. How do you make decisions on your team? What are your ideas and your principles around how a team should operate? If you can't articulate that to me, it means you're not clear on your leadership operating system. If you're not clear on your leadership operating system, then how are you going to lead? And that's why it's so difficult for a young leader. They don't have that operating system. It doesn't exist yet. And we don't equip them with the tools and the mental models to start filling in the gaps. They just have to do it themselves. And of course, what happens then is that over time, they accumulate bad habits, bad behaviors, and this becomes ingrained in the operating system. It influences the teams, and on we go.
I want to move that conversation out of the boardrooms and into households. Like, one thing that I've realized coming out of COVID and stuff like that is, especially as a husband, that you need to be a strong leader in your household as well, and in your personal life as well. Like, just the way that you conduct yourself, the way that you interact with people, how you take care of your relationships and all those kind of stuff. So for me, the one level of leadership is obviously the stuff that we spoke about now and that we're going to unpack a little bit more. But I think there's a great sense of leadership that we all have a certain sense of responsibility and accountability towards, in terms of you, how you lead yourself and how you lead your family, if you are in a relationship or married or have kids or whatever the case might be. But I don't think we often focus enough on that part of leadership as well. We often think about how you conduct yourself in a business and how you act and what you do, but we don't take that necessarily home in a way that I need to lead this family in a common direction as well. I need to view my family as a team, and we on our way to achieve this goal or to do this as a family unit or to make this impact or just to do something, you know. Otherwise, you just coexist for 80 years and die together, and then it's the end. But I think there's so much beauty and energy and power that can come out of a situation or out of a family if we all are united in terms of this is what we want to achieve as a unit, and that's where we're on to. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I fully agree. I actually made a video about this yesterday in a very similar vein, which is, there's that quote from Viktor Frankl that goes, between stimulus and response, there's a space. And in our space lies our greatest power, the power to choose how we respond. And when we hear that quote, the impulse is for us to go, okay, this is about how we go through our day. That as I go through my day, things are going to happen to me, and the power that I have is to choose how I respond to the things that happen to me in the day. And that's very true. That is, of course, what the quote means. It's one application of it. Another application of it is that the stimulus is that you have been either self-selected into certain roles or appointed into certain roles. So I've self-selected into being married and being a partner to my wife. You might have been appointed into being a leader at work. But irrespective of whether it was self-appointed or appointed by someone else, that stimulus creates a responsibility. And you need to think about, from a broader point of view, from a grander point of view, how am I going to show up? And it's so easy for us to forget that these roles come with big responsibilities, and we need to calibrate the kind of person that we want to be in that relationship or in that situation. So, yeah, I'm totally with you on that. We need to bring intentionality to every aspect of life, and it's very difficult because we are so busy with everything else. But intentionality is ultimately the thing that moves us forward in the areas of life that we care about.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about intentionality, because I think that's probably one of the most endangered qualities of being a human currently, especially with technology evolving and with social media at like its peak now, where we become so reactive to what we see or what we do. And I mean, like, let's get really practical. If you think about going away this weekend or whatever, you're going away to the place where what you probably see on Instagram in the next couple of days. You're going to see an advert for a lodge, and you're going to be like, okay, that's the one. Where usually it was like, I really want to go to this place, or I really want to experience that, or I really want to see that. That's just from a complete like left side point of view. But like, how do we cultivate intentionality in our work, but also at home, in a way that we are constantly living from the inside out and not from the outside in terms of absorbing information or absorbing what we see and what other people do and making that our narrative or that our way of operating, but rather really soul searching yourself and knowing that this is Marku, this is Eric, this is what I like. And I also refer back to the days of Facebook where you had to like everything that like you're really passionate about, your music, the places and stuff like that, and you used to see all of that, and then the algorithm changed. But it's almost like you had this portal that kind of mirrored what you liked and what you knew about yourself. But I think that has faded so much, and we're really just becoming the product of our environments and what we see and what we do. How do we change that? How do we unlearn that behavior? Because it's not easy. You can't, well, you can, but not many people are going to jump on the bandwagon of deleting all your socials and becoming like completely remote. So how can we approach that in a sensible way, where we become a lot more intentional in what we do and what we say, and monitoring and managing the outside forces?
So what does it mean to be intentional? It means that we are purposeful in how we act. We are deliberate in the things that we do. So the first step is that we need to know what that actually looks like. And this has always been the most potent question in coaching, is that whenever we talk about something, you know, we want to be as specific as we can be. So when we say, I want to be intentional, okay, cool, what does that look like? And you'll find that for most people, they'll actually struggle to articulate what intentionality looks like in their life. But intentionality just means that I'm going through my day and I'm doing things that are purposeful and that I've selected because I know that it means something to me in my life in some way. It's going to move my business forward. It's going to impact my relationships. Every action that I'm taking or every decision that I'm making contributes towards something meaningful and important to me. Whereas if you are unintentional or if you're on an autopilot, you are just doing whatever is in front of you. You are just doing things because it is fun or it's distracting to you. There's no deeper meaning or reason behind it. It's not contributing to anything specifically in your life. And so what I end up thinking is that, you know, when we think of the recalibration process, if we want to be intentional, to me, that means that we are always moving towards the thing that we care about. So what do we need to do? We need to interrupt the drift. that's what you're, that's what, like everything you were speaking about is that the moment you get sucked into social media, the moment you start playing comparison games, the moment you become unconscious of what you are doing, like all of that is just drifting. So the more we can interrupt the drift, the better. The more we can, what's what I'm looking for there? Let's stick with interrupt. The more we can interrupt that drift, the more intentional we become. One way to interrupt that is that you need to remind yourself that you want to be intentional. And it sounds like a kind of a silly thing to say, but what I've come to realize over time is that there are just so many things happening in our lives that if we aren't reminding ourselves of what we want to do and who we want to become, then we are likely not to do that. I remember when I just started coaching, it was the weirdest thing to me. People would come for coaching. So it means you sought me out as a coach. You paid a lot of money for me to coach you. We would talk about a action that you should take within the next week or two. And then you'd come back into a session and you didn't change. You didn't do the thing. And I'm like, why? Like, this doesn't make sense to me. And then my initial thinking was, you don't care. But then what I realized over time is that we do care. It's just that there are a million other things happening in our lives. And I've often made it like on the Sunday, I'll decide, okay, I'm going to do things differently tomorrow. And then I get to the end of like the Monday, I'm like, oh, geez, I just did it again. Why? Because I forgot to remind myself that I need to do this new thing, you know, go out of my way to change something very specific. And so I remember with maybe like 7 years ago, I was in the market for a new backpack. And I had a friend who I spoke to, he's sort of a collector of cool gadgets and toys and stuff. And so I said to him, listen, like I'm looking for a backpack, what do you recommend? And he sent me to this website for a backpack from a brand called Nomatic. So I gone to the website, I see the backpack, I'm like, wow, like this looks amazing. You know, beautiful design, sleek, it, like folds out, like all these amazing features. I get down to the bottom and it's like $300. For the backpack. And I go, like, I'm never in my life paying $300 for a backpack.
Quite an investment.
So I'm like, okay, well, that was interesting, but, like, scroll away. And then, of course, the moment I do that, I go onto Facebook, there's the backpack. And I go onto LinkedIn, and there's the backpack. And for the next 2 weeks, this thing just follows me around on the internet everywhere I go. And what would happen is every now and then I click back to it, and I go and look at it, and I go, oh, but, like, maybe it is worth it. Like, look how cool, you know, look how nice this design is. Then I'm like, no, get to the price. Like, not going to do it. And I did this dance back and forth. And today, if you find me at a gig, you'll see that I have that backpack with me. And the reason for that is that the advertisers are smart. They know that retargeting means that over time, you convince yourself that this thing is important. And they just, all they have to do is just keep it top of mind for you. And so if we want to change, we need to keep that change top of mind for us. If we want to be intentional, we need to keep what we want to be intentional about top of mind for us. And so really intentionality for me starts with being able to sit down in the morning and to identify what would it look like if I'm going to be intentional through my day. And to do that every day as your way of not forgetting. And in that way, you are retargeting yourself to be intentional. I think that's the only way we get to do this. You don't get to be intentional without putting in the effort up front to be intentional.
Mm. I like the language that you use in terms of us derailing from what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve. I want to get super practical and ask, like, what are some parameters that you can, like, to stay in your lane, to make sure that you are constantly on track to reach your North Star? For me, that usually comes is I feel that in the way that I act and respond, I'm not bearing fruit. I'm unkind, I'm unhappy, I'm stressed, I'm super anxious. And all those other things that come with it, when I that's kind of my indicators that or perimeter lines where I know that I'm kind of bearing off from the track that I should be. Are there other, or for the people that might not know how to put those parameters in place or what they are, is there some knowledge we can share in terms of how you can or get to that point where you know that once this starts to happen, you're off track and you need to recalibrate yourself? Mm. Like, what is it for you? How do you know when you've drifted off?
So what it is for me is when I wrote the book, I wanted to, well, the book was supposed to come out pre-COVID. COVID happened, so we delayed the book, obviously. And in some ways, it actually helped me in writing the book, because I was going through survival mode so often during the pandemic. You know, initially, my business boomed and things were going really well. And then it hit this peak where it really slowed down. And even in between then, like when things were going well and you were seeing like all the devastation in the world, there were still days where I felt I woke up in survival mode, even though things were actually fine in my business. But what that made me so acutely aware of is, how am I showing up when I'm in survival mode? So instead of trying to just rush out of it, I almost wanted to sit in it and be like, okay, so I'm in survival mode at the moment. What am I feeling? What am I experiencing? Okay, I'm recognizing what this looks like. And I think because of that, two things happened. One, I had more empathy for people who were in survival mode. I realized today that if you are deep in survival mode, it's very difficult to get out of it. Whereas before, I would have been like, oh, come on, man. Like, we can make a few changes and you can move. Today, I have a deep respect that there were days when I was in my deepest survival mode. Doesn't matter what you tried to get me to do. Nothing would have changed me on that day. Like no amount of meditation, no amount of feel good music, no amount of external motivation would have done anything for me on that day. All I needed was just to take the day and to say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to try again. So it gave me that respect and understanding for deep survival mode. But the second thing it did is that now I know. When I'm lying in bed and I'm thinking about worst case scenarios, I go, I'm in survival mode. That becomes my trigger, because I've taken the time to just feel what it feels. And so when I know that now, I'm like, oh, okay, you're in survival mode. So actually, like, you're catastrophizing. This isn't going to happen. Like, know that your mind is just playing tricks on you. But it comes back to you needing to cultivate daily self-awareness. And the only way we get to do that is to have a practice of self-awareness. So to come back to the first part of the question, which is how can we make sure that we are moving in the right direction? How do we put up guardrails that we aren't drifting? There's the evaluation aspect, which you spoke about, which is more subjective. It's me feeling that I'm not showing up the way I'm supposed to feel up, how I'm supposed to show up. And then there's the measurement aspect, which is, if I've decided I'm going to do X amount of calls per day or X amount of meditations per day, am I getting to that number? So you can have a subjective side to it and more objective side to it. On the objective side, I know I need to send out my Build Better Teams newsletter twice a week. The Daily Leader goes out 5 times a week. The expensive podcast goes out once a week. When those numbers start slipping, I'm like, okay, well, something's happening. I need to recalibrate. So you can either use a very objective measurement like that, that tells you when I'm at my best, this is my output, or you can use a subjective evaluation, which is, okay, I can feel I'm not quite where I'm supposed to be. But the subjective one is kind of like a ninja level type thing, right? Because for you to be able to do that accurately, you need to have had the self-awareness to know, okay, well, this is what I'm supposed to be feeling like. And more importantly, you are able to dissociate yourself from how you're feeling now to evaluate that I'm not quite there at the moment. You know what I'm saying? Because often, like, let's say you know what it feels like to be operating at a 9, but you're currently sitting at a 6. What you've done is you've created the skill to go, okay, I can zoom out, I can see I'm a 6. Whereas if you haven't taken the time to do that, all you are doing is you are stewing in, oh, I'm a 6. You are just sitting in that emotion. Mm. You aren't able to dissociate from it.
If we move on from that, I'm going to ask you something in terms of, and I want the complete honest answer, but it might be quite a vulnerable place to go. But what is something that you really struggle with now? And what are some of the challenges that you're currently facing, that you're navigating within yourself or within business or something that you're currently dealing with?
Look, my biggest I'm turning 40 next year. And I guess you, well, I'm sitting in that place where I'm like, I'm not where I want it to be. I look at the, and I, it's tough, right? So like, I talk about this idea of accretion often, which is that we accumulate the small things in our lives, and the small actions and the small decisions give us the life that we have. But the thing about accretion is it's the same as compounding, you know, obviously. And the number one rule of compounding is never interrupt compounding. But I've done that all my life, is that if I just stuck to physio, I would have a thriving, massive practice today, probably most likely multiple practices. But I was compounding, and then I broke that chain. Then I started Better Man. And we had 18,000 men, and we were 18,000 strong on the newsletter, and we were bringing out our own merch, and we had the events going, and we were doing morning masterminds with the guys, and this was growing, growing, growing. And then as it was hitting peak, I cut that chain, and I started a new one, which is keynotes and workshops and working with leaders. And so now for the past few years, I've been compounding that. But it's only been 4 or 5 years of doing that. So I know that if I keep compounding for the next 10 years, I'll have exactly what I want. I know I'll be, I have a mostly international practice, might even be living overseas. I know I'll have more books out. I know that the podcast will be bigger. I know my personal brand will be bigger. I can see how those things all happen in the next 5 years. But just looking at where I am today, it's frustrating that I'm not further than I want it to be. And the main reason for that is that I've just been interrupting this compounding effect along the way. So that's something that I'm always grappling with a little bit, is I wish I was more successful than I am. But that's maybe like the most top of mind one for me at the moment. I've struggled with many other things in the past, like imposter syndrome used to be a huge thing for me. These days, I don't feel that as much. But yeah, I'd say not being as far along as I thought I should be or as I wanted to be.
Mm. With that feeling in mind, do you still feel fulfilled and that you're flourishing in life?
Yeah. Yeah, so I told you we moved to Somerset West 2 years ago. And it's amazing how when you change your environment to or how it changes you. And so in Somerset, I actually couldn't be more content, to be honest, with my life at the moment. Apart from not being where I want to be, I get to wake up every morning and look over the ocean. And it's always been a dream of mine to be close to the ocean. It's a place that just refreshes me. So I get to wake up and we kind of at the back of Somerset, so we're looking over the entire Somerset and I see the ocean. So I get to do that. I turn my head a little bit right and I see Table Mountain sitting there. Then I have my two dogs that I like adore, and I get to walk with them every day in the Helderberg. Get to play paddle on wine farms. I'm like, there's not much that I like.
Good life.
You know, I'm so happy. And so, yes, I think there's this tension that I'm not where I'm supposed to be. But at the same time, like the environment that I've created now is just so nourishing that I can't not be fulfilled in that space. Mm.
I think that's a healthy place to be, though. I think in terms of if we ever get ourselves to that point where we feel comfortable enough that we don't feel like we've achieved what we wanted to achieve, we're going to be, not dangerous. You know? We're going to be the ones that are complacent and that. But
for sure.
Like, we also have that intrinsic, like, inner voice that I think the most important thing is that you can control that voice and understanding. And using the language that you've used, I am content where I am now. Mm. If I had a checklist of the things that I would really like in my life and that adds value and meaning to me as a person and to my life, those boxes are ticked. And I'm living fully into those, but I also have this burning desire to still accomplish much.
Mm.
in what I'm passionate about and what I really want to do. Having said that, I think fulfillment and happiness is quite a difficult thing, and contentment, if we maybe want to group them, is quite a difficult thing to achieve, especially in our day and age, where with the intentionality that we spoke about and social media having an effect on that, and also AI coming into that space. Is this something that we can share with the listeners in terms of how did you get so clear on Somerset West, two dogs, happy wife, looking over the ocean? Like, how did you get so clear on that picture would make me happy, and actually reaching that and then feeling that feeling?
I'm so happy you mentioned happy wife, because that's that's a big part of if you want contentment, happy wife, yes. You know, life has always just unfolded in front of me. And so I didn't know Somerset West would give me this level of contentment. I didn't know that having the two dogs would give me this level of contentment. It's kind of just been trying to put one foot in front of the other. And I think often when we listen to interviews and we listen to like people who have achieved the level of success or who might have what we want, what we want is like their roadmap to that, you know? But it's not always helpful, because you can't just copy my roadmap. And I don't even think I had a roadmap, to be honest. You know, I didn't have a clear path from where I am, from where I was to where I was to where I am today. It's just been an unfolding process. But what's been driving that process the entire time has just been that I want to be more intentional, that I want to find things that are meaningful to me, that I want to have more of an impact. And so when you make decisions informed by the things that you care about, hopefully you end up where you're supposed to end up. But I think it's very difficult to reverse engineer these things and always get to the same outcome, you know, because there's also so many things that have to kind of fall into place along the way, a certain level of luck that happens along the way. But my feeling is that at least have a destination, you know. Somerset West was never a destination for me, but, and when I say a destination, I'm not really talking about like a location, I'm just talking about like a goal, like have your goal that you are working towards. And as you work towards that goal, life is going to happen and you will come to certain crossroads and you will make certain decisions. And even where we are today, it's just temporary. Who knows what's next? You know, it's just always this journey that we are on. And the only question really is, which decisions and which actions are you accumulating? That's really all. Like, just focus on the journey. Just focus on the best decisions for today and the best actions for today, and let the rest take care of itself as you go along. I don't know if it's a very satisfying answer, but I think that's the best answer I have for it, if I'm totally honest.
And I think it comes back to the driving force that actually motivates your decision, because I've got this question here in terms of, I want to know what motivates you at your deepest level. Like for me, why I started Flourish, and even probably Imagine This as well, was I wanted to help people. There's this weird feeling that I get when people leave the boardroom or leave the consulting room or leave this office, and they leave there happier, better, in some sort of better state than they came in. That gives me a big kick. So maybe it's super selfish or whatever the case might be, but if I conduct my decisions in that way, where the way that I interact with people, even if it's just somebody at the supermarket, I want them, after their interaction with me, they need to have a better afternoon, you know? What is that driving force in your life, if you have to ask yourself why, until the deepest level, what would the answer be to that?
I think it's very similar to yours, is that I just want to be of service to people. I do have this... this feeling, though, that when we look at business, you know, that there are stakes attached to how people show up. So let me run you back. When I was still working in the different hospitals, most of what I was doing was intensive care units. And over the years, I probably treated thousands of patients. But you always have these cases that just sort of stand out to you. And one such case was a lady that, so when I arrived at her bed the morning, you know, like ICU is the charts on the outside, patients on the inside in the cubicle. So I arrived at her bedside, and on her chart, it just said multiple GSW. Do you know what GSW stands for? Multiple gunshot wounds. So I go into a room and I speak to the nurse, because obviously the chart doesn't tell you the full story. But what happened is that the day before she came home from work, it was a day just like any other day, nothing special about it. She pulled into a garage, she closed the garage door, and as it was coming down, three guys slipped in underneath and they wanted to hijack her car. They didn't manage to do that. They did manage to shoot her four times though. Three times through the chest, one bullet went through her jaw. So by the time we got to her, she'd been stabilized, but she was still unstable. You know, so like they took all the bullets out, they sewed up what needed to be sewn up, but she had arrhythmias, her blood pressure was fluctuating all the time. They also had to sew her jaw shut because, you know, like when you break an arm, you have to immobilize the arm. The bullet fractured her jaw, so they had to sew her jaw shut so she doesn't move it, which was the first time I saw that as well. So it was very, very, very heavy walking into a room on that day. I used to open my keynotes with that story, by the way. Mm. And then people are like, I thought you were supposed to be a motivational speaker. I'm like,
you're doing this wrong.
It's getting there. It's getting there. So fast forward 12 weeks, and she walked out of that hospital. She was smiling, she was speaking to her friends and her family. Her journey wasn't done, she still had lots of rehab to go through, but she'd been given a second lease on life. And what I realized looking back at that is that what got her to that point wasn't just one person, it was a group of professionals, of experts in their field who came together to work as a team to get her to the other side. So we had the surgeons who stabilized her, who saved her life in that moment. We had the nurses who were monitoring her 24/7. Physios were there to mobilize her, occupational therapist to help with the activities of daily living, dietitian to make sure that she was, or she had the nutrients she needed for healing, the psychologist to help her process the trauma. And so everyone helped her to get to that point. And yet, when you look at how we were trained as medical professionals, we never had any training on collaboration. Nothing was ever done to help us figure out how to be a good team together and what does that look like. And so when I left the healthcare industry for corporates, I thought, well, surely like once you enter into business, businesses get and understand team sports because this is the business of, that's what they do. And yet, like we've just said earlier, leaders don't know how to lead teams. Teams don't know how to team because we are never taught how to be a good team. But yet, the stakes are quite similar. You know, in healthcare, the stakes are if we don't work well together as a team, you might lose a life. If we don't work well together as a team in business, we lose livelihoods because if a team doesn't perform, a business doesn't perform. If a business doesn't perform, it can't sustain the people in the team. And so there are stakes attached to how we show up. And for us to get leadership and teaming right means that we impact people's lives in a very drastic manner. And so that's a very important part for me of why I do what I do, is I want to help people get it right.
Eric, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been following your journey on LinkedIn, I think literally since you made the transition to Better Man. And it's been such a privilege to see what you do and how you do things. And also the way that you articulate and practically outline the conversations that you have in terms of what are actionable steps, how to do it. Because I think a lot of conversations around this space can be more up in the air and more of this is the way that you should reason and think, but you take it to a granular level where you actually practically lay it out in such a way that young leaders, experienced leaders can take that information and knowledge and practically apply it in their lives. And it's been a great contribution towards my own personal development and my leadership style.
Thank you.
And I appreciate that. So thank you very much for,
you. Thank you.
For sharing your story. We have a closing tradition on the podcast. I'm going to ask you a few quick fire questions, cool. and you have to answer with the first thing that pops up in your mind. Which book are you currently reading?
Sure. All I can think is Dangerous, because it's like on my, it's currently on my bedside. I need to think about my Kindle. I can't think right now.
Okay. Do you read your own books after you've written them to just like...
When I wrote Dangerous, I was like, I'm writing this book so I can remind myself of this every single day.
Interesting. That's amazing. Best piece of advice you've ever received?
Don't take life too seriously.
Name one item on your bucket list.
What are those balloons in Turkey?
Oh, okay, yeah. The yes. ones that look over the whole yeah. Turkey.
Was it Cappadocia?
Okay.
Yes.
Your go-to activity to unwind or relax?
Walking with my dogs.
What series are you currently watching?
What series? My wife is away in Germany visiting her family, and whenever she goes away, I'm just re-watching Suits all the time.
Oh, cool. So I have the same tendency to watch stuff, but mine is documentaries. I like watch like war documentaries and all kinds of crazy stuff. What's a favorite sports that you like to play or watch?
Golf, paddle.
Your favorite outdoor activity?
Golf and paddle.
Right, final question. Complete the sentence. Life is all about
finding meaning.
Sure. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
If you're looking to sharpen your edge, grab your copy of Dangerous. Available on Takealot, Exclusive Books, and other trusted retailers. You can also listen to The Expansive Podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening to the Framework to Flourish podcast, hosted by Marco Haasbroek and produced in collaboration with Imagine This. For today's episode, Stefanie de Toey was our coordinator, with Kayla Neetling as the assistant. John Rehoog was our technical producer and Karina Kloppers our content producer. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram or LinkedIn at Flourish Workshops to stay up to date with our latest episodes, workshops and retreats. Until next time, keep going and growing.